It is Shabbat Vaigash, as you can see on the screen there. It's a beautiful, beautiful passage. Just listening to it there in the Hebrew this morning, it's one of the beautiful sections. Come near. And it's just wonderful. I love it. It's one of my favourites every year. The portion there this morning came from Bereshit. That was chapter 45 in Genesis 1 to 8. From the Haftarah, Ezekiel again, what a wonderful passage, one of our all-time favourites, of course, as always, is chapter 37, the dry bones coming together and Israel coming up to form again, a mighty nation, having been broken apart for so long and lifeless without the Ruach, without the Spirit, and yet God again breathing His Spirit upon our people to rise up a mighty nation, a prophecy that is soon to be fulfilled. And in Messianic writings, I thought I would give you something a little bit more controversial this morning from Matthew 23, 6 through to 12. And I can almost hear as that portion was being read out this morning, people around the world, at least maybe those who are watching, who are antagonistic towards what we're doing, going, see, there it is. Even Yeshua himself said it. But I'm going to come on to a bit more about that in a moment. We're entering a critical part of the Yosef and brothers narrative and the scenarios that are now apexing through the portions that we are currently in. We've spent the last couple of weeks living Yosef's life in the text and in our sermons and discussions as we do every year. What an amazing, amazing biblical historical character Yosef is. You know, just the sheer volume of text given to this man is quite phenomenal, actually. He's clearly a really important person in Israeli and Jewish history in this way. And he is, as we know, as we reach the scenarios that we are talking about today, as it peaks in all of this, as crazy as it may seem to us today, the brothers, in their physical and hunger need, and their absolute sense of unworthiness before the mighty Egypt and its princes, in this case, Yosef, their brother, as they're driven by their needs, go to Egypt, a country they know they're not really meant to be in, for food to live. And now before this mighty man of Egypt, with everything that's going on in the brothers' heads, they fail to see what is literally right in front of them. It's quite astonishing. And I want to put it to you that the scriptures are very clear about this at this moment in time. We are dealing with things that are facts, and yet they are not perceived to be so. But they are real. They are facts. Yosef is the brother who was lost and assumed to be dead and gone. The other brothers standing before Yosef that he recognizes, he knows they are his brothers. All of this is the facts that the scripture gives us, and yet we have a scenario that unfolds before our eyes which seems on the face of it to be completely crazy. And I know we can say, yes, but Yosef had his Egyptian makeup on and he was speaking Egyptian to them and they didn't connect with it in that way, and the brothers were older and they were obviously hungry and maybe leaner, and you know, we can look at all of the external packages of all of this, and yet the facts are the facts in it all. The brothers are literally standing close opposite to each other. The human reality, the actual brother is standing there, and they don't see him for the truth of that reality. They just don't. Yosef speaks roughly with them, and we begin to see something quite incredible happening through all of this, beyond the mere physicality of this situation. Because the fact is, this is the brothers standing opposite each other, And yet it's not the facts that dictate what we see happening here. It's the words which are spoken which shape the perception of the scene unfolding before our eyes. Not the facts, but the words that are spoken. The scripture tells us that Yosef speaks roughly, abusively, harshly with them, and sets up a verbal scenario by his lips, by the use of his words, whereby at one point he even labels the brothers as spies, and consequently Yosef's minions, like, spies, right, straight to prison with you then. The reality is, they are not spies. They're not. That's the verbal scenario Yosef creates to deal and act as he feels he needs to at that moment. If you put it this way, his words created the reality on the ground that enabled him to lock his brothers up. That's just the first set of his words. His second words are this, which again totally transform the reality in front of them. They're now brought again to the brother, as the passage that we heard today, and he says, what, five short words to them. I am Yosef, your brother. Short sentence, and yet words that were spoken which utterly transformed the scenario and their perception of reality and the truth that was standing before them. You could literally say their whole world changed. Five words. The reality is nothing had changed. He'd always been their brother. They were always part of the family. That's always been the fact of everything, running behind everything that we see here, and yet it's the words that are spoken which go on to set up the scenarios which are intriguing and fascinating. What other sentence, apart from Yeshua's "I am He" in Yochanan chapter 18, has caused such a profound reaction and change in perception? I am Yosef, your brother. The scriptures go on to say that the brothers were dismayed in their response. In John 18, when Yeshua says, "I am He," it says the people literally fell back. Something powerful was changed in perception by the words that they heard and understood. Words change the territory literally before our eyes. Their view of reality at that point was broken before their understanding. Their eyes, they thought they understood what was happening, and suddenly the words change everything. It flips on its head. Words. Words, so important. The words we speak, what we say, our understanding of situations. I'm kind of going to call this a part two, really, of what I did 2 weeks ago when I was talking about truth. Because truth needs a form. Truth needs to be expressed. Truth comes out in language and in words. And it's how we say things and how things are couched which literally frame our perception of reality and what we're facing. I'm going to take you on a short verbal journey here to show you how words can change things in your head. So you're sitting at home. It's the end of the evening news. It's 10 o'clock and you turn on the BBC. Or not, but let's just assume that you do. And you hear the headlines. Russian militants continue to be killed in their thousands in the Ukraine, a country designated by the British government as a sovereign nation. Wouldn't you wonder if you were living in a parallel world? Have you heard a headline like that? Ukraine designated as a sovereign country by the UK government? You'd be going, whoa, 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 hang on, whoa, whoa. Sorry, Ukraine is a sovereign country. What are you talking about? And yet what do we hear? Hamas, designated as terrorists by the UK government. They are terrorists. We don't need to couch it in language and words. mealy-mouthed, to pander to whoever we think we're pandering to. What we hear, what we say, the words we speak actually go on to frame the reference that we, how we then go on to see the world. And I've been pondering it this week, you know, two conflicts that we're looking at right now. You know, look at Ukraine, look at Gaza. Two conflicts which have provoked crazily different responses. You know, in this country it's like kind of, yeah, go get those Russians. Those dirty Russians invading Ukraine, go get them, yeah, you know. I don't see demonstrations on the streets of London decrying the thousands of Russians who have died in Ukraine. Where are the demonstrations? Where are the banners? I don't see it. I haven't seen them, heard them. Why? Because we've kind of decided who's the bad guy, who's the good guy, and that's the way it is. But it's language in all of this. And yet with Gaza, we see completely different responses, different verbal cues and descriptions that people use and say. Oh, we know that we support Ukraine in the West, of course, but Israel? Maybe. Maybe not, we think. We don't, but certainly in the UK and other Western countries. I said in my last sermon that the truth was the first casualty of war. It's deeper than that, actually. It is words and their use that is the first casualty in war. And at any time, actually. How we use our language is absolutely critical to how we understand the world. We may not see it in that way, we may not even consider it in that way. You know, we all know, don't we, in the background that words change and have their meanings changed and so on, but it's way more fundamental than that when you begin to peel back the layers. Because it seems like in today's world that we're in a state of flux as regards words, their meanings being forever debated. Everything that is spoken is deconstructed. Someone picks up a gun, are they militant, are they a soldier, are they a combatant, are they a freedom fighter, are they a terrorist, are they a deranged psychopath? Right? The words and lists and titles go on and on and on, no one even knows anymore. I mean, there was a time that someone would pick a gun up and shoot someone and you would know that is evil, they just did that. Not anymore. You need to know what school they went to. You need to know whether their dad spanked them when they were three. You know, because they were a naughty boy. Have they just come out of the army? Were they just going into the army? And the list goes on. You know, you can't. It seems in today's world that no one is able to make any understanding of the things that we see. And we have lists of words able to describe multitudes of situations. Because no one seems to know where they're going anymore. On one level, you know, this is nothing new today. It's always been like this. But we've reached the dizzying heights I want to suggest to you today. That every word is capable now of a full meaning reversal. In a world where truth is untethered and reality formed according to whim, the following words have today, at least in our time, become real. This is what Isaiah said when he was looking at just this kind of situation. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own understanding and sight. In other words, woe to you if you think that you have the ultimate power to define any word that you are using. Now I know I'm just blundering into a linguistic debate here on one level, but there's a serious point to this. When we begin to say, I choose to use that word in this way, we are setting up ourselves as a culture and a society for a huge fall. When words have lost any form of absolute meaning, then we merely become like sounds blabbering in the wind, uttered forth that bring forth confusion and uncertainty, just like at the Tower of Babel. No one knows what you're talking about anymore. You know, I'm free to call a table a chair if I want to. Of course I've got the freedom to do that. If I go home and say I'm going to set the table, set the chair for my dinner, you're going to go, what? And I can say, that makes sense to me. Well, Mazel Tov, doesn't make sense to me. I don't know what you're talking about. And of course, you've got the freedom to change the meanings of words if you want to. But the problem is when you begin to do this, it's not just the words you're deconstructing. You're beginning to change the very fabric of our existence, of our understanding of existence, and how things work. And you've got confusion and chaos in the wake of all of this. Don't tell me that Hamas is just perceived to be terrorists by the UK government. They are it. It's the very meaning of the word. And there's something in me every time I hear this which rebels against an abuse of the English language in this way, because it feels like my mind is being messed with. And it provokes me, spiritually and otherwise. Because the moment we reach that point, we are lost. And no one knows what is good or evil, up or down, black, white, bitter or sweet. You know, you can take a Mars bar and bite into it, says Isaiah, and you go, oh, this is really bitter. I love it. And everyone goes, you're nuts. Yeah, but I'm using bitter for sweet now. That's what I'm doing. I chose to do this. When we arrive in a society like that, Isaiah says, woe to you, because you will not stand anymore. Need to know what is good and evil, right and wrong. And those words intrinsically hold those meanings, and if we erode it, we are in trouble. Look, people, you see this everywhere today in our world, in gender politics, identity issues, pronoun use, the woke agenda. I could go on. You all know it. You've been there. You've heard it all. And while we may have some measure of sympathy and empathy and understanding within this broad, complex wokeness and everything else, it's not just one blob. We need to be more nuanced than that. Of course we do. But in all of this, is the way the world is currently unfolding and choosing to express itself in language, we are at risk of losing core ideas and thoughts, realities, rights and wrongs and structures of the world. We are at risk of losing this, and we will perish if we bend these things. Number of times, you're in a conversation with someone, and they'll say something, 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 and they go, oh, can I even say that? You know there's something going on in the culture. When that's going on, this is my meaning of the word. I grew up thinking it was X with X and Y with Y, but I'm not sure, can I even say that anymore? And it reveals the tension that's going on in the world right now. When communication breaks down to such an extent that you can speak the same language, but you're simply speaking past each other because you're not even hearing it. And we all know who the author of confusion is. And it's not Hashem Adonai. The author of confusion is Hasatan, the enemy, the one who constantly spiritually opposes, attacks. Shaul said, you remember, when he said this, let everything be done in order, he was not being a control freak. He was not trying to master everything and get on top of everything. He wasn't just talking about liturgy in the ancient Siddur either, although that is the context of that verse when he says that everything be done in order, b'seda. Of course that is. But he's talking with a much broader understanding of what we as Jews, as Israel, those who believe in Torah, believe in Scripture, believe in the revelation that God has given to us, we know that God is the God of order and stability. These are the domains of the Lord. And so he says, well, let everything be done in order. What Shaul is saying, please, people, let us live our lives within the structure that God has given us and use the words that he has given us to frame it and bring understanding to our lives. To do so is to walk away from having our very minds framed by what God has spoken, and then we're in chaos, instability. It's interesting, is it not, to note that it's God's words that bring order to the anarchic creation in the beginning. God spoke and it brings order, structure, a framework to it all. You know, I've often wondered this, that, you know, why is it that the scriptures talk about in the beginning it is darkness and then comes light? Why doesn't light come first? Why don't we see something that illumines and gives insight and structure and understanding and revelation? Why doesn't it begin with that? Why begin with something chaotic as darkness? And it's simply this, because what God does, he says right at the very beginning, he brings light to darkness, order and structure to chaos. Tohu bohu. There's chaos. It's all mixed up in the beginning. And God speaks and he brings order and structure and certainty and stability and meaning and understanding to everything that was there in creation at that point. God's words frame creation and give it that structure and meaning. It's why we are living in a world of meaning. Because God's words mean something, absolutely, and they create this form and structure that we live in and have our lives within. It's a powerful metaphor for the power and use of words that actually help or hinder our understanding of life. Words are important. They frame existence, our expectations, our perceptions. Now look, the idea for linguists is nothing new in all this. We've known this for a long time. But the reality of it is being underplayed. And I believe in our culture and society today, it is being seriously underplayed. Let me give you an example. You and I, I'm sure, and I certainly get asked this, and we all do when we fill out forms or whatever, and people sometimes officially ask you, do you have a partner? Do you know what I always say? No. I have a wife. I'm married. And they look at me like, kind of, that's what I meant. No, I don't care if you thought that's what you meant. Partner, wife, and husband do not mean the same thing. Have courage, people, to step up. You're not ashamed if you're married. It's not just a partner. Is it important? Absolutely it is. The words may share some of that same meaning space, but they are not identical. Words impart meaning, understanding to the world, and will lead you to think in certain ways. One of my early favourite books, we're going to laugh now, I'm sharing a bit of myself here, was this wonderful book. It's called The Lexicon of Soviet Political Terms. Now, I know it's bedtime reading for most of you, I know, but I bought this when I was 18. I knew one day it would have a purpose. We could have put a photo up in the thick and we could have done that so you could see it. Subtitle is A Guide to the Soviet Orwellian Alteration of the Russian Language. Manipulation of a Language. Why did I find this interesting? I bought this as part of my linguistic studies back in the time, and we're talking in the 1980s here, but I found it fascinating how simple words, and it's in English, so you do English translations, but I was studying Russian at the same time as well, how simple words could be used in a very, very simple sentence and yet mean completely different things to different people who were hearing it. And it really struck me, it intrigued me, and it has ever since, as I was connected with linguistics for all my life, really, in one way and another. The way that words are used, you can use things in, just one word can be used in completely different ways to mean different things. And one of the things the Soviets did with their communist ideology was to deliberately change the meanings of words. Because they knew that if they could do this, they would make people communists. Because it would frame their view of the world. And they were right. Do you have a partner? I have a wife. I'm not going to allow my mind to be framed by this world and its expectations, its view of how things should be and could be. I'm going to allow my mind and the words of God to transform my mind into seeing the world as he sees it. Because that's how he created it. And to allow our minds to be transformed in this way by his words that understand this world, we will truly live in it as people who deeply understand all of this and can give it meaning. You know, Jewish people, and in particular, I think, Messianic Jews, are some of the few people on this planet today who actually do understand what is going on in Gaza right now. Generically, with the wars that Israel has suffered since we've been back in the land, we understand it. Why? We have the prophets. We have the scriptures. We understand this conflict today originated way back with Ishmael and Esau and the brothers falling out. This is a family issue we see being fought out on the streets of Gaza today. Who else understands that? We do. The rest of the world don't. They just see it clouded by understandings of, you know, the big one who's the bully oppressing the poor underdog of the Palestinians. And we all love the underdogs, right? That's a worldview that's being imposed upon that situation. It is wrong. The underdog can be just as evil as anyone else. That's a fact. You've got to look beyond the ideologies and the worldviews that are being presented around us today. Words have meaning. I mean, go back to being the wife there and the husband and whatever. The very word marriage itself, arguably one of the most biblical words, going right back to the garden. And yet today that word is up for grabs for redefinition. I mean, it's not for us, but it is for many. Marriage is marriage, and we know what marriage is. You read the scriptures and you know what marriage is, right? We see it everywhere in today's world. The choice of words. Not even that long ago, a little bit before this, but go back to Nazi Germany, when the Nazis created a word in German, the Untermensch, the subhuman. And who did they apply it to? The Jewish people. And you can say, oh, it's just a word. No. It's not just a word. The moment you apply that word to anyone, you are debasing them, trivializing them. You are removing their sense of value and worth in society. And once that word had been sown in German minds, persecution and attacks soon followed. Actions follow words. Always. Once the German people began to believe, because of the way that language had been changed for them in Germany, Nazi Germany, once they began to believe that Jewish people literally were not really fully human, once they begin to believe that, it all follows on. First you denigrate the target group you want to hate verbally, and eventually you move to the actual physical violence. It's always the way it works. There's a process, and it happens first with words. You know, I was looking around this week. I'll give you a couple more examples here. And you know, I grew up at a time when if you were going to go to India at all, someone would go, oh, you've got to go to Bombay, right? Bombay. Now, I'm just on risk of offence here. Forgive me, I'm not doing it in a sense to be offensive. It's not called Bombay, is it? What's it called? Mumbai. Why? Because that's its real name. Why is it called Bombay? Oh, wow, right? Words aren't just words. They've got meanings, they've got history, they've got baggage. Happens all the time. A British Empire loaded name put upon it. Do you know, I did a bit of research on this for our Portuguese speakers here today. You'll be impressed with this. Apparently it was the Portuguese who first called it Bombay, which means good bay. Apparently. That's what the Portuguese arrived and said, oh, this is a good bay. And so it becomes Bombay. If we go back even further in time than that, you'll find Mumbai actually takes its name from an ancient pagan deity, apparently. So it says in the research that I found there. And it was later, of course, you know, since 1995 it was changed back to Mumbai again because they wanted to reclaim the identity and the background as Indian and so on. And rightly so. No closer to home. Let's get real close to home here. On one level, we can talk about Jesus, On another level, I suspect most of you just said, Rabbi, did you just say? On one level you can say, it's just a name, it's just a word. No, it's not just a name, is it? Jesus has no connection with Judaism or Jewish history. I mean the word. The name he had was Yeshua. I know people say to us, oh, but you make too much of this. You're fighting over words. Words are important. Really important. Yeshua means salvation in Hebrew. Jesus means nothing in English. So let's use the Hebrew. Let's actually use his real name. And you can say, oh, but Rabbi, this is so typical of the Masonic movement. You're just doing this for ideological purposes. Just get a grip, he's called Jesus. No, he's not called Jesus. We as Masonic Jews should insist upon using it. We are not the ones who are using his name for ideological purposes in that sense. It is his name. So let's use it. For everyone. It is accurate, it's historical, and it is rooted in Jewish understanding. Now look, don't misunderstand me. I understand why Christians and rabbinic Jews today want to continue to insist on using the fake name. I get it. They want to keep perpetrating this because it means something and they're using it in that way. Weaponizing the word, if you want to put it that way. I get it. It's being used for an ideological agenda. But we should be calling his name Yeshua. Words mean things. They create the environment in which we live and function and understand. You know, it's crazy, isn't it, that Jewish people insist on talking to us about Jesus. And I would say, and forgive me, I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but when people come to me and say, Jesus this, Jesus that, I always go, who? And of course it's designed to be shocking. You know, I'm a bit like that. But I want to make a point. Yeshua is his name. Let's start using it. Oh, and by the way, none of us should be using the name Yeshu either. That again is a rabbinic Jewish ideological name used for Yeshua in a dreadfully negative and disparaging way. Words mean things. Be careful what we say. Again, just to touch upon this very quickly. You know, the bit we used this morning from the Masonic writings about Rabbi, without digging deep into it, it's not my intention to try and explain why Yeshua was saying that on one level, but it is interesting and important for that being contentious. You know, Yeshua also says, call no one father. So don't go home and say dad or father today, because Yeshua says you shouldn't. And clearly it's nonsense. And therefore, equally, nor do we take at face value when he says, don't say rabbi. Clearly, he's not saying that. He's getting at something deeper than that. And we can hint at it when he look at about what he then goes on to say about the high places and so on. He says it's about humility. That's what that is all about. It's about not aching for and yearning for exalted titles that in your own mind make you bigger than you are and blah, blah, blah. Yeshua says, look, whatever. Titles really aren't that important. Just be humble in what God calls you to do. That's what he's kind of saying through all of this. But we know, of course, the term rabbi today is used broadly in other forms of Judaism too. And people do take offense at us using it. I know that. I understand that. I deeply do. And it's not deliberately used to cause offence in that way. But one of these situations that we've been talking about a lot in the last couple of years with all of this is, you know, Messianic Judaism in the first century had community leaders, of course it did, but we don't read about them being called one thing or another. It was all in a state of flux, and let's be honest, even the term rabbi wasn't used within rabbinic Judaism until we're getting much into the second and third centuries. All of this came later. It was only beginning to be used as you go through the first century. So even that was fluid in that way. Names, meanings, words, they are important. Why we use them, how we use them, our rationale for it, what we're projecting and so on. And it does, on the one hand, concern me. If people look at me and say, you're a rabbi, oh, you must be Orthodox. I suspect in the same way, if you're a reform or a liberal rabbi, you experience the same clash and tension that goes on there. This is about looking at meanings of words, but what else do you say? I think it's hilarious within Christianity you've got vicars and pastors and all these kind of words which were invented. They're not in the scriptures either. Pastor, that's a spiritual gift, it's not a title. What do you call someone who leads a Jewish community? I will leave that one hanging. But rabbi is certainly one of the words that are used. How about the word Gentile? Oh, you want real controversy? Here we go. Buckle up, people. Let's have a look at the word Gentile over the centuries. You know, the original use of the word Gentile was not a Jew. That's what Gentile effectively means. Putting it another way, someone who does not worship the one true God. That's what a Gentile is. Hello. People who are listening online are going now, but. That is what the word Gentile means. According to the Torah, there are two groups of people on the planet. There are Jews and there are Gentiles. There's not a third way. You're either in one or you're in the other. And the Jewish people are the ones who worship the one true God. That's what it means to be a Jew. A Gentile, according to the scriptures, is someone who is heathen or pagan. You might say closer to modern English to use it in that way. And that's not a value judgment. I'm being just merely factual linguistically. And yet today, you can claim to be a Gentile and believe in the one true God. And anyone who actually knows the original use of that word Gentile in that way would look at that and scratch your head. In fact, we can see exactly how this word is used. If you go back to Joel's letter to the Corinthians, just one little verse in here is an illustration, but here it is. It's in the scriptures. If you think I'm not illustrating the first century here, it's in 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 2, where Shaul says now to the believing ex-Gentiles who've come into Messianic Judaism, and he says this: you know that you were once Gentiles, carried away to these dumb idols, however you were led. That's his definition. There it is in Corinthians. You were once Gentiles, says Shaul. Shaul clearly understands that they are no longer Gentiles. That's a sermon for another day. But the reality of it is there. That is the way the word is being used, even in the Messianic writings. Words matter. It's why we stand against Lashon Hara. You know? Words which might be partially true, but used in a way to cause harm. Words matter. We stand against gossip. We don't tolerate slander, either in person or on the internet. If you are trolling people, stop it. You should not be doing it. If you send abusive emails to people, full of hate speech, to cause them harm and pain, stop it. It's against the Torah. It's a sin. Words matter. That is not how we are meant to be using words. Again and again we read in the scriptures, encourage each other. Use your words to build each other up and not attack or bring down. And one final thought in all of this. The word for meaning in Hebrew, mashmaot, if you've got Hebrew ears on you there, you'll hear something in the middle of mashmaot. You'll hear the word shema. Isn't it interesting that in Hebrew, the meaning of something is directly connected to listening or hearing? And I'll put it to you this. It comes back to our thought about words here today. Only as you listen to God and His words do we actually get any kind of meaning into our lives at all. If you want to have a life filled with meaning, listen to God. Not this world, not to anyone else. Listen to God. I have to say, as a linguist, I find it intriguing that our prime directive, Shema Yisrael, is to listen to God, not read His words. Again, I find that fascinating because words are part of it and reading is part of it. Our command in our prime directive is to not read God, but listen to God. We're meant to actively listen to Him, not just read the words. You know, there's if you know anything about linguistic skills, they're broken down into two categories. There's the active and the passive. The active are the speaking and the listening, and the passive is the reading and the writing. Reading and writing is something that man has invented. Speaking and listening are innate to being a human being. They're of a higher order linguistically. We speak because we're human. We listen because we're human. And our prime directive, first and foremost, is not to read, but listen to God. I know people will say, oh, you can't listen to God. That's fairy tales. God is too distant. He's just a force in the universe. That's absolute rubbish. You can listen to God. And if you're not hearing God, then I feel sorry for you. Because the scriptures are clear. We should be listening to him. We should hear him and be able to hear him. His words give meaning into our lives. It's God's word we need to hear and understand, and not the words of this world. In fact, if you want more on that, go away and read Romans 1. It fleshes out those ideas in far more detail than I want to hear today. But God gives us that meaning as he speaks. And so we see the world as he wants to see it if we are willing to listen to him. If we have the courage then to use our words to define and structure our lives in the face of this world. To have the courage to say no, good is good and evil is evil. This is this and that is that because God says so. And use those words to structure your life in a way which exalts the truth of who our God is. I see what's happening in the world. I worry deeply the way that people's minds are being messed with through language today. And we need to be the people who get back to using our language in a godly way, in a real and righteous way, in a truth-filled way. Because it all starts with what we're listening to. So the question I want to leave with you is quite simply this. Who or what are you listening to? Because that will frame your life. Who are you listening to?